Good afternoon and welcome to Dateline New Haven on WNHH-FM. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Well, we're looking a little bit into the future today, folks. We're going to be visiting with a gentleman who is going to be helping New Haven tick for years to come and help us also learn some secrets about what makes us tick as human beings. Nicholas Turk Brown, welcome to Dateline New Haven, WNHH-FM. Thanks for making the time today.
Thank you for having me. Delighted to be here.
So, Nick, I'm just going to tell our listeners that you're the man in charge of a new neuroscience research center and institute that Yale is launching. They just announced it, and it's going to be at 100 College Street, that big tower that was Alexion before there was Alexion moving. And it's going to be a brain research center, the Boots Sci Institute, that studies how the brain works, human cognition, and explore human potential. They're going to be looking into how our brains grow, change, and rewire, and explore memory and reasoning. So obviously that has implications on everything to our healthcare, to how we interact with machines, to how we learn, how we create art. So Nick, tell me, how are you going to do that? How's this new institute going to work, and how's it going to accomplish this goal?
Well, the study of the brain and the mind are, as you noted, at the root of who we are as humans. It's how we come up with creative ideas. It's how we interact with each other. It's how we have personality. It's how we become experts at things. And so in many ways, this is one of the most fundamental, elemental aspects of science. And so the question is, how do you tackle that, something that's so intrinsic? You know, as humans, we are studying ourselves, our own minds. And so that's a real question about how do you study the brain and how do you link it to aspects of our behavior and our thoughts and language and so on. And so that's the field of neuroscience, the study of the brain. It's got a lot of connections to different disciplines. So I'm a professor of psychology, for example. I study human mind and behavior. It also touches on biology. How do molecules and cells work together to, you know, compute different kinds of information to process what's going on in your brain, all the way up to computer science and data science? How do we make sense of our remarkable abilities? And so I think the core idea behind this institute is to try to bring all those groups together, the psychologists, the biologists, the computer scientists, data scientists, towards a new understanding of how the brain works. That's the general goal.
You know, and every time in human history, I think we always have the hubris of thinking we're at a more exciting time or interesting time. Am I wrong that we have leapfrogged tremendously in all those areas you talked about? Have we been making advances into how the brain works, into how to get lots of data to look at understanding reality, chemical reactions, biology? Are we at a moment in time now, especially with the technological advances we made, that this is an amazing time to do this?
Yeah, it's a great observation. There's a fantastic book called What Remains to Be Discovered, because we always have the feeling that we've made all of the foundational discoveries, but we don't know what we don't know. And you're absolutely right. It's a really exciting time on many fronts. In fact, the field of neuroscience started with this idea of trying to understand the mind. But in practice, the way people went about studying that was very different. So you could be a biologist studying, you know, molecules and cells and genes, or you could be somebody studying behavior, or you could be studying algorithms. And all of those individual threads have made outstanding progress in recent decades. And so time is ripe to bring them together towards a shared understanding. And I can give you examples of the progress in each of those fields.
Give me an example. Give me one or two really good examples.
So just a quick example is we have incredible new technologies for studying the human brain in action. You can't open up the human head, so you have to use techniques for peering into the brain that are safe and ethical. And so the advent of functional magnetic resonance imaging, the ability to peer into the dynamic function of the brain as it's working, as you're remembering, as you're seeing, that's something that only became available in the mid-90s. And in the last two decades has seen remarkable progress. And you could tell the same similar story at the biological level, the techniques that have been developed, the idea of optogenetics, being able to turn.
I'm sorry, what's the phrase you just used? Autogenetic?
Optogenetics. It's the idea of using light to turn neurons on and off to manipulate different aspects of brain function, not in humans, but in animal models. And then on the data science side, you've seen it in industry, the proliferation of deep learning, machine learning, devices, artificial intelligence. And so the idea is to bring those together. We're not trying to build better machines. We're trying to draw inspiration from our own remarkable capabilities and to learn from that about how it is that the brain generates these
properties. Are we going to understand ourselves better? Are we going to understand how to live better? Are we going to understand what God or transcendence or whatever we want to call the unknown that we've never gotten nearer? We can get nearer to that?
Well, I won't touch religion, but I will say that one of the core aspects of the human mind is beliefs, whether it be beliefs about other people, beliefs about politics, beliefs about the world, beliefs about religion. And I think it's one of the most ephemeral things to study. There's a lot of really rich research on this in psychology, but can we ground that in an understanding of the brain? That's not impossible here. So I think we are going to know more about how we develop, how we become who we are, how we store memories. Why it is that we get along with some people, but not others, and what we're good at and what machines are better at and what we're just better at. And why is that?
Nicholas Turk Brown is the new director. Is that the right title, Nick?
Yeah.
Of the Wu Tsai Institute at Yale, which is going to be a neuroscience institute exploring our brains. Now, you were talking about the different kinds of research being brought together, biological, technological, data science. Are you creating new jobs and new divisions here, or are you just taking three parts of Yale, putting them in one building and having you guys have lunch together and sitting next to each other and sharing those ideas and coming up with projects to work on together?
Well, some of the best ideas happen over lunch or coffee, so I won't dismiss that. But there is a lot of exciting growth associated with this initiative. So we have real strengths at Yale in these areas, as you noted. And so part of the goal here is to bring those groups together. In that building, there will be the Department of Psychology from the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. There'll be the Department of Neuroscience from the School of Medicine. There'll be some folks from data science. But a lot of the investment associated with this institute is in incremental growth, growing. And so that means hiring new professors, nine new external recruitments of professors and all of their research groups, all of their administrative research, technical support staff, graduate students, postdocs. There's an administrative enterprise here too. It's sort of running the institute. And so we're hiring staff for that. We're going to have space in the building that's dedicated to supporting the mission of the institute. So this is a new thing. And this is really oriented on building on strengths, but growing in new areas that help to connect those disciplines.
Just watching you, I could tell how excited you are.
Oh yeah, I'm delighted. This is exciting. What an opportunity, because I really, truly think we're at a moment where we can make a difference here.
How many, do you have a dollar figure for how much that size? This is a Joseph Tsai from Alibaba and Claire Wu Tsai are putting this money up. How much money is this and how many new jobs is it?
Yeah, I've been told it's a historic, transformational gift. That's all, I've been told.
So they're not saying how much yet.
No. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, do you have any number of new jobs, any estimate when you added all those things?
Well, if you add it all up, I would say probably about 100 jobs. It'll happen in time because hiring is, in academia is fairly slow, but those would be jobs to support all of the scientific and administrative functions of the institute. There's also a lot of work to be done to get the building ready. It's going to be the floors that we're going to occupy in the building are being gut renovated, including installing a lot of, advanced technologies for studying the brain. And so there's going to be a lot of, economic development around building out the actual institute.
How many floors are you guys going to have?
So the institute is sort of planned for about 2.5 floors of this building. It's about 80 odd thousand square feet. So it's a lot of space. But the rest of the building is that part that Yale is associated with will include departments and others that are connected to the institute. So I think all told, Yale is programming about 5 or 6 of those floors of the building right now.
Okay. And as you said, those 100 jobs are on top of existing jobs.
Yeah, that's all new. Yeah.
Yeah. So Nick, can I break down, even though the whole point of this is integrative, bringing different aspects of research together, which makes a lot of sense. Can I break it down a little bit for you? I mean, for our listeners, for one reason is like, they think about why does this matter to me?
Right.
Like, you know, as resident of this planet, one of it is healthcare, right?
That's one.
When I'm looking at your work as someone who doesn't know anything, part of me is thinking, well, you'll come up with new medicines, probably for Alzheimer's and memory loss, which means a lot to me now in my 60s.
All of
or will there be non-pharmaceutical insights? Will there be ways to know, you know, the way the old-fashioned insight, if you do crossword puzzles, your brain stays more fertile? Yes. Are you going to be studying that kind of thing on steroids? Meaning, are you going to have insights into ways we can naturally keep the brain vibrant?
Yeah, so I would say... Well, two answers. The first is there's a lot of potential impacts of this because it's so central. You've pointed out the sort of clinical medical aspects of this. In order to understand what goes wrong in neurological disorders, neurodegenerative disorders, you have to know how things are supposed to work, right? If you're a mechanic and you only ever get the engines that are broken down, you wouldn't know what to fix to make it right again. And so there's a cycle. You have to iterate between understanding how things work when they're working to know how they go wrong when they're broken. And then you learn from how they're broken and that, right? So it's a iterative process. So there is that connection for sure, even for something focused on basic science. The second is that a big focus of the Institute is to understand how humans learn and grow and change. That has tremendous potential for helping to accelerate and improve education. The impact of neuroscience on how we structure schools and teaching and learning is a field, but it's a relatively untapped space to use modern understanding of the brain to guide what's the best way to teach our kids and to teach ourselves as adults. That's a real impact. And then the third I would say is on technology, right? Technology plays a huge role in our life. What's the best way for us to interface with technology? Are there ways of brain-computer interfaces? If we understand better how the brain works, we build technologies that augment or build upon our capabilities that work with us better. Can we think about ways that humans make a contribution that technology can't? So to help understand our role going forward in an increasing technological society, what can we do to help? So now, that's one side of it.
What can the human brain do that theoretically AI will never be able to do?
Well, I'll give you an example. I think there's obviously a lot to say to that. I mean, there are some functions of humans like consciousness that are hard to even think about in a machine context, although there are philosophers working on that problem. But just to give you an intuitive example, I can ask you a question like what I didn't come up with this. This is something, you know, that's been bandied around, but what's the Pope's phone number? You could tell me immediately you don't know what it is.
Right.
What did you do? Did you search a database of all the phone numbers you know? Not that you know that many phone numbers anymore, but you get the point. Humans are really good at knowing what they don't know without doing an exhaustive search. That is not something that's trivial. So that's one example of a function.
We couldn't ultimately program a computer.
You could give it a database that it could search to find information, but that's not how you answered that question. On the other hand, I could give you a very long arithmetic problem that a computer could solve in microseconds that would take me or you, you know, weeks to work out. So well,
isn't part of the question here, though, what is ethics? We have this idea that as humans, we make moral and ethical judgments. I would guess that some people in your field would think those can be reduced to neurological reactions, that we think we're making ethical and moral judgments, but we're really having reactions to survival instincts, tribal instincts. Am I wrong about that?
So, you know, there's different views on the right way to think about complex phenomena like that. And there's a reductionist, I've called approach, where you can say, explain everything at the level of biology. There has to be some truth to what you're saying, that our ability to make ethical and moral decisions is grounded in our brain. If we didn't have a brain, we wouldn't be making ethical, moral decisions.
But could a computer ultimately make those decisions, especially if you're a utilitarian?
Yeah.
If you believe that that has to do with survival and what's the best way for us as human beings
yes.
to do well, then you could argue a computer could make that. But if you believe, because you brought up the word consciousness, if you believe consciousness has some kind of ineffable quality, that there's something about consciousness that can never be reduced to zeros and ones. There's something about human nature, being a human being, that, or an animal, really, because we're learning more about the animal world, that we're not so unique. But is that a trite notion?
Well, I would say that this is a big issue right now in AI and machine learning. There's a growing evidence of pretty significant biases and inequities in the application of technology in our world. And so I think this is actually an area where we can contribute as an institute to understanding what makes us moral agents and what makes us behave ethically. When are we responsible or culpable for our actions? I've had some fantastic conversations with people in the law school and philosophers about how an understanding of the brain could be used to help in the judicial system to judge culpability, for example. So I think we can touch on that. And just like you can't understand an engine by only studying broken engines, I don't think you can fully understand artificial intelligence until you understand natural intelligence. And I think that's where we're going.
Is there a limit to where these psychological and philosophical questions go? For instance, some people say you gotta be crazy to murder somebody. So does that mean when you're talking about those questions that then get brought before the judicial system from your study of the brain, say, if by the dint of creating this antisocial act, you're kind of crazy, that means you're not responsible for it because you're crazy. Are we entering that kind of turf of, are we still getting into like understanding why we do things in the, how the brain contributes to the decisions we make and how much we're responsible for and how much we're not?
Yeah, I can't judge that specific case, but I would say that there had been a lot of work trying to do this. And these are disparate fields. There actually hasn't been a lot of historically science guidance about these questions about how to evaluate the moral status of somebody who does something right or wrong. And so I think that is a connection. I don't, the translation into the judicial system there's been attempts for like lie detection. That's one case for judging responsibility, for thinking about brain development. When does a person become in control of themselves as they're developing, right? Why do we treat minors differently from adults? So these are the kinds of questions that you could get at. So yeah, just to get back to your broader question, I think sort of health, education, technology, law, those are some. You also asked a slightly different question though that I didn't answer, which was if we understand this, how can we sort of use this knowledge to better ourselves? And I think that there could be work on this. We're interested in trying to understand, why is it that your attention sort of fluctuates? Why do you lose focus sometimes? Why do you get distracted? And could we teach people to recognize when that's happening and be better focused? Can we help people learn in a better way? You know, ultimately the goal of learning is to change the brain. That's what it means to be in a course or in a online, class. Is you're absorbing information that's changing your brain, and then you're carrying that to a new situation and using it. If we know how the brain is changing based on information, can we use that to guide how we learn as individuals? Why can't we learn a second language, you or me? Whereas, my daughters, who are much younger, can just sit around and absorb any languages that they hear.
I can't believe the difference from 12 and 15 years old and 60 years old, inability to pick it up. I'm talking to Nicholas Turk Brown here on Dateline New Haven, WNHHFM. Nick is the new director of the Wootsai Institute at Yale, this historic donation we don't know the number of that's going to fill several floors of 100 college seats for a new neuroscience institute to study the brain, how it works, and how we can make a better world as a result. Nick, as we said, you're really passionate about this. It seems like you've been passionate looking at your background about neuroscience all along. You've gone through the field of psychology. We got you from Princeton. How did you get into this field? What was there a moment where you said, aha, this is what I'm excited about?
Yeah, it was a book that my father gave me called Phantoms in the Brain.
Phantoms?
Phantoms in the Brain, about a phenomenon called a phantom limb syndrome.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with that. You know the Suzanne Vega song, Men in a War?
Right. So this is, it's the phenomena where if somebody has a limb amputated, because of an accident or a military conflict, they continue to feel pain in that limb. Well, what does that mean? That means the pain wasn't in the limb. The pain was here, right? So we feel things in our body that's generated from our mind. When we see things in the world, we're not seeing the thing in the world, we're seeing it in our mind. That got me interested in the idea that our brain is creating our reality. Everything we take to mean the world is really generated. And once you adopt that view, it becomes really interesting to ask, how do different people experience the world? How is our experience of the world distorted from the reality of the world in front of us? And so those are some of the ways.
How old were you when your dad gave you that book?
What's that?
How old were you when your dad gave you that book?
Oh, that was in the late, must have been the late 90s. I think it came out in 98. And so I was finishing up high school at the time. It's probably 16.
What did your dad do for a living?
He's a sociologist. And then eventually he transitioned to becoming a union leader, and he got involved in politics. He's done a lot of different things. He works in, he's retired, but he lives in Toronto now.
Mm-hmm. Your quote is saying the brain is remarkably good at predicting the future. How can memory be used to know what will happen next? Are you going to have a sideline here on doing a GameStop trader prediction? where are you going with that one, Nick?
Well, I mean, this is a really interesting development in this scientific field, that we have the feeling like we live in the moment, or we at least try to live in the moment, but actually our brain is a few steps ahead. What our brain is doing is processing what's going to happen in a few seconds up to a few minutes. And you could see this if you look at people's brain activity, brain sort of mapping out what's going to happen in the future, even while you're experiencing the present. And so how do you do that? How do you know what's going to happen in the future? Right? That has to be based on your past experience. You can't, you know, you're not telepathic. You can't predict a future that you haven't experienced before. It's only because you have memory that you're able to generate an expectation of what should happen based on what happened in the past. So that's one of the things we study. We work with people who have no memory, for example, because of brain damage, and they don't do this, right? They're really in the moment. And if you interrupt them or you leave the room, they have no idea who you are. They've lost the thread. So this is a really essential part of our existence.
Well, maybe this isn't a full understanding of what you said. Isn't there also a counter imperative to live in the moment? That if we live too much in the future, we're not experiencing the moment and we're not maximizing our potential through what's happening in the moment, or not?
Yeah, I mean, there's this idea of mindfulness, sort of being aware of what's happening, body sensations, what's going on, appreciating the moment, savoring the moment. I think that's all good. That dilates time. It makes us have richer experiences. It also makes us more focused. So that's a good thing. But the critical thing about this idea of prediction is that it makes us better, makes us more efficient. If you're really just reacting to things that happen in the world, you're going to make mistakes and be slower than if you're proactive. If you see a car stopping in front of you, you can't wait till you rear end the car to brake. You got to brake ahead of time. And only if you do that far enough ahead of time do you succeed. So that's the idea. Your brain is always doing that sort of calculation.
Is there another tendency of the brain to fight the last war? Like after 9/11, TSA has us taking off our shoes for 20 years because that's what the guy did last time, the shoe bomber, rather than thinking ahead to what people would do next. Why as a collective do we as humans not function the way that you're describing the brain functioning to look ahead?
That's an interesting connection. I haven't thought about it that way before, but I think we are somewhat bound by the things that we know and that we've experienced. You see this actually in research on problem solving. You know, you're trying to figure something out, and in order to find the solution, you have to recombine information in a new way that hasn't been done before. And so some great examples, of experiments where people fail to solve very simple problems just because it breaks out of the mold of how they think about the problem. So this is a challenge we all have in our thinking. That's very conscious thinking. And a lot of the prediction stuff I'm talking about happens below the surface. It's just your brain's always-
I'm wondering, is there a difference between the way an individual brain works and a collective brain works? I don't want to go deep, way, way, way beyond my expertise level of what universal-
No, this is great.
As a group, do humans in an organization tend to look backward more, and do individuals have a greater ability to think ahead and creatively and unconventionally?
I think there's certainly differences across individuals in how they think about problems, how they see problems. I think that's the essence of why we feel self control and free will is that we behave differently in a scenario than somebody standing beside us. So I think there is something unique about individuals. And I think the wisdom of the crowds is a real phenomenon where when you put different viewpoints together, you get a better answer.
And is this tied in all with the neuroscience center that Yan Liu Haven is building down the road from you guys?
Yeah, so it's a really exciting development. The hospital system is building a clinical neurosciences tower. This is not, you know, explicitly connected to it, but there are some research connections. So, for example, in my lab, we study people who have epilepsy, and if patients who have really severe epilepsy often will go in for neurosurgery to remove the part of their brain that's causing seizures that can be debilitating. They can't hold a job. They have, you know, very significant impacts. So these are patients who are having a part of their brain monitored and potentially removed. And before that happens, we can go in and record activity in their brain and work with the clinician.
But do you see a link up? Will you be doing some research in conjunction to the clinic?
Yeah, so we'll be not just, you know, my group, but many different research groups at the university work with different patient populations, whether it be epilepsy or Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, or more, you know, lower grade cognitive impairment and dementia, where it's not, you know, debilitating yet, but where you can start studying how age affects memory.
And I've noticed that, you know, this human brain you're talking about, there's been a lot written recently, you know better than I do, about the insights into primate brains and other animal brains, that they work a lot more than we ever gave them credit for. Any impact on the research you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, so this is a neuroscience institute that takes a very integrative approach. There's some ways of studying the brain that you can only do in other organisms, from worms and fruit flies up through mice and primates and ultimately humans and machines. So yeah, there's different advantages of studying different kinds of brains. One advantage is that different animals behave differently. And so we can look at variation in the brain as a way to understand variation in behavior. But also some of those techniques I mentioned, this idea of turning the brain on and off with light, that's only possible in certain species where you can make receptors that respond to light.
I let you go. Nick Brown, the inaugural director, most interesting new institute starting in New Haven, Yale starting it, by the Wutzai Institute of Neuroscience studying the brain. I guess the launch is this winter through summer, stage two is new faculty, and then fall 22, you move into a Huntington College. Is that right?
That's right. So we're in this period now of sort of fleshing out what the institute will be with the plan to move into the building in the fall of 22.
Well, I wish you the greatest luck. Thanks for coming on Dateline New Haven. Boy, what an interesting person you are, what a wonderful field you're in. And I just hope that you guys knock it out of the park and come
Thank you, Paul. And these are really great questions. I look forward to talking with you more.
And I want to thank Harry Dros, our station manager, the man behind the controls. So thanks for joining us today on Dateline New Haven, 103.5 FM. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience, performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass inviting you to fly free with us all day and all night at WNHH 103.5, New Haven's home for community radio.